Welcome to the Reason Podcast. I'm Catherine Mengue Ward, filling in for Nick Gillespie. Don't forget to rate, review, and subscribe at iTunes. I am here today with Gene Healy of the Cato Institute. Hi, Gene.
Hi. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for coming. We are here to talk about your glamorous, glorious cover story in the current issue of Reason Magazine. It is unambiguously titled, Goodbye, Obama. And it's about the president's legacy. Can you tell us what your thesis is?
Well, I think his legacy, kind of surprisingly, is going to end up having inherited a already vastly powerful presidency from Bush Cheney, and having campaigned on turning the page on that imperial presidency, he has concentrated. He's actually, as he grew in office, ended up growing presidential powers. And now he hands over a fairly fearsome arsenal of enhanced executive powers to Donald J. Trump, a man who he said was temperamentally unfit for the presidency and someone who couldn't be trusted with a Twitter feed, let alone the nuclear arsenal. So I think as that shapes up to be an important part of his legacy, it's understandable if he feels a little depressed. This was not, I think, quite what he was expecting or what your neighbor who put the Obama hope sticker on his Prius was expecting would end up to be the Obama legacy.
There's a great photo of the first meeting in the Oval Office after the election with Trump and Obama shaking hands. And Obama's face is like, you have got to be freaking kidding me. And Trump's face is like, I don't know what I'm doing here. Do you think that there is this inevitability about the growth of executive power? I mean, you've been writing about this for years. You wrote about the cult of the presidency in your last book. To me, as a sort of child of the late 20th and early 21st century, it just seems like, well, of course, executive power is going to grow and grow eternally until, I guess, something sort of apocalyptic happens. Is that the wrong way to look at it? How could this be stopped?
There certainly are a number of factors that aid the growth of executive power. You know, Dick Cheney's probably not the first one to say it, but he used to say that the mission of the Bush administration was to leave the presidency stronger than we found it. And it turns out that almost every president does. So I think it would have been unrealistic to think that Obama, a man who sort of campaigned as the second coming of JFK, was going to radically downsize executive power.
He said he was going to, right?
I mean,
that's the thing that makes it at least somewhat legitimate to cry foul. Is he said, you know, he would improve transparency and decrease the use of executive privilege where he could.
Yeah, and there's some indication that he felt sincerely about that, but not really a lot of activity in that area. You know, that there's a. Folks like Jeffrey Rosen, formerly the New Republic, now at the National Constitution Center, had greeted Obama as, quote, our first civil libertarian president. Even though it's easy to make fun of that in retrospect, Obama really did have a profile that was somewhat different than what you typically get, a former constitutional law professor, high rating by the ACLU, state senator who had done some civil liberties work, and a different sort of profile, and certainly on the campaign trail, a lot of attention to the problem of the growth of executive power under the Bush administration. So I think what it comes down to is you're very unlikely to have someone, however, who goes through what it takes to get to be president, do what it takes, you know, in a over 2-year cycle of glad handing your way around Iowa and New Hampshire, the sacrifices that are needed to actually get elected, to expect that person to turn around and say, well, now that I've got the ring of power, I'd like to give it back.
Tell me about the law of succession, which is something that I had not heard of before I read your piece, and which I think has a lot of explanatory power.
Yeah, it's Theodore Lowy, political scientist, wrote a book called The Personal President. And in it, he coined Lowy's law of presidential succession, which is each president improves the reputation of his predecessor. And it included a corollary, which is this is the only guaranteed contribution that each new president will make.
And this was 30 years ago that he wrote this.
It's turned out to be right. I mean, for the most part, it reminds me of that sign that billboard somebody put up a few years ago with Bush, "Miss me yet?"
Do you think there's like another corollary, which is that each successful candidate for the presidency also improves the reputation of the candidate that he vanquished? I mean, I know that I'm having a certain kind of bizarre nostalgia for other Republican candidates in recent years who, at the time, I thought, ugh, anybody but that guy. And now I'm like, well.
Yeah, maybe Mitt Romney fits into that.
I think
that
Romney is definitely part of this sort of third corollary to the presidential law of succession. So talk to me a little bit about the specific ways that Obama has kind of enhanced and expanded executive power. Because one thing I've noticed is that as he's headed out of office, there's already this kind of fight over the facts. Did he or did he not use executive orders more than his predecessors? Did he or did he not promulgate more regulations? I'm hearing from people who want to kind of burnish Obama's legacy. Oh, no, that's unfair. You know, it's actually not true that he was a user or abuser of executive power. What's your take on that?
Well, I think the legacy of enhanced executive power is clearest in foreign affairs.
Which is now the place that people are most nervous about handing those powers to Trump.
You know, George W. Bush had a very expansive theory of executive power, of inherent power to do whatever the president wants in the name of national security. But in the two wars that he fought, he got congressional authorization. Granted, while denying he needed it, he did actually, for Afghanistan and Iraq, get authorizations for the use of military force. Barack Obama, depending on how you count wars, I mean, we sort of – they're hard to separate out in an era when Obama is the first – two-term president to be at war every day of his presidency, but depending on how you count, at least two unauthorized wars, Libya and the current war against ISIS, a radical expansion of the 2001 AUMF, or authorization for the use of military force, that Congress passed after 9/11 to go after al-Qaeda and the Taliban. Obama has completed its transformation into a blank check for permanent presidential war. I think he leaves Donald Trump with a pretty shocking legal legacy of the president's power to use force.
Talk to me about what happens when presidents use executive power for ends that you like. Because this, I think, is a place that's a little bit tricky. When we say, okay, we don't love it when Obama uses executive power to wage 17 new wars without congressional authorization, but, you know, frankly, when he used essentially that same theory of the presidency to open up some of our, you know, some pathways for immigration, I'm like more torn about that. And particularly if you're someone who doesn't think that there's something sort of intrinsically valuable about the way that these underlying rules are written, but just that they're good guidelines to prevent an abuse of power. How do you, as someone who's really made a study of executive power, parse, you know, good versus evil? When do we become instrumentalist about the use of executive power? And, you know, keeping in mind that it's the presidents themselves who are being pretty instrumentalist about it. They're saying, well, if it's good ends, who cares how I got there, right?
Yeah, I think the immigration policy under Obama is a good example. Yeah, like many libertarians, I don't have a problem with the substance. I think if you, you know, with some 11 million undocumented immigrants in the United States, the basic substance of what was originally supposed to be the DREAM Act makes sense, right? You don't want to the category covered by the DREAM Act, you know, children who came with their parents, no criminal record, and the other criteria that Obama essentially implemented by executive fiat. It all makes sense. These are not the people that you would want to deport. However, he did, you know, with the stroke of a pen, grant legal privileges and eligibility for federal benefits to nearly half of the undocumented immigrants in the country. That's a kind of sweeping use of executive power. And what's worse about it is it's emerging now that Donald Trump, who's pledged to undo a lot of this, should not have any problem legally doing that. And the immigrants who actually applied for DACA, under the Obama executive order, well, now Trump has their contact information and a lot of their identifying information, which would make it much easier for him to deport this particular class of citizens should he choose to do so.
So you think it's partially just the undermining of trust in the government, or maybe the sort of increase in political risk for people who are trying to follow the rules and do the right thing?
That's part of it. But also, look, Trump is going to use unilateral executive action to undo a lot of things that Obama implemented by the same means. And in some of these areas, even libertarians are going to like a lot of what Trump does. But it really does set up a situation that undermines the rule of law when you can have vast areas of American law, immigration law, healthcare, energy policy, undone or reinstituted with the stroke of a pen. Hamilton, in the famous Energy and the Executive essay of the Federalist Papers, said that one of the reasons you wanted energy in the executive was because it supported steady administration of the laws. Well, now it's just the opposite. If every 4 to 8 years somebody can come in and undo what a prior president has done and institute a sweeping new set of policies, you really don't have predictability and the other values that go along with the rule of law.
It also starts to center rent seeking or favor seeking in the executive, which would be a pretty dramatic shift from our traditional hallowed way of doing business, which is to center rent seeking and favor seeking in the legislature and in the bureaucracy. Do you see that as something that is likely to happen under Trump? I mean, you could argue we're already seeing that with the carrier deal, that he sort of put up a sign that says, you know, I'm going to be the one handing out the deals here. Does that strike you as something that's different in kind than what we've seen before, or just different in approach or kind of style?
Well, it could end up being different in kind. I mean, the carrier deal is what we know about it is pretty troubling. We don't know how much the threat of removal of defense contracts played in that, but you know, you have the president-elect very publicly chastising a company and then working out a deal where his vice president is, has sweetened as governor of Indiana with tax incentives. It does raise a troubling situation where you wonder how much economic success is going to depend upon whether the president likes you. And given that Donald Trump is on his Twitter feed on a nightly basis railing against people who criticize him, you could actually see this kind of behavior have a chilling effect on criticism of the president.
That's interesting. So there's a speech angle to it as well. Can you look into your crystal ball for me and try to guess what is Trump going to do that's going to be the hardest for libertarians to condemn? That is, what's he going to do that we're going to like, but he's going to do it in such an awful way that we're still going to have to say thanks, but no thanks. What's his parallel going to be for the Dream Act?
Oh, that's tough to say. I mean, he I think libertarians are going to like some of what comes out of what he does in healthcare. They're going to like to the extent that he's able to undo the Clean Power Plan. I don't know if I can, off the top of my head, come up with a specific example that I've been thinking about, but I think it's going to – look, we have a problem in this country where voters and even political elites can't see beyond one or two presidential election cycles, and that's why – you have this sort of situational constitutionalism where, the out party is the one that's concerned with the concentration of executive power. And once your guy is in, you know, concentration of executive power seems to look pretty good. The problem is, you know, the presidents come and go, the presidency changes hands, but there's a ratchet effect to this concentration of power. So, while conservatives and libertarians are cheering some of the revisions of what Obama had done in terms of executive fiat, the longer term problem is that this concentration of power is going to continue. And well, I don't know. Trump already looks like a thought experiment that you'd make up to try to scare liberals straight about the concentration of executive power.
It'll be interesting to see if it works, right? I mean, I'm already hearing a little bit of the murmurs of strange new respect that libertarians get from the left every time a Republican wins the White House, right? I mean, even from the very anecdotal evidence of my Twitter followers and my TV booking, suddenly it's a lot more MSNBC and ACLU than it is, you know, Fox and Red State. But do you think that do you think there's any chance that this is a lasting change? I mean, this is the question that we ask ourselves here at Reason every 4 or 8 years: is this a new permanent coalition, or is this just the natural pendulum swing of partisan politics?
There probably is no permanent coalition. I mean, we've been through this before, right? There was the strange new respect in the Bush era.
Right.
And then when Obama was elected, there was a mass demobilization of the anti-war movement and liberal commentators calling for Edward Snowden to be tried for treason. You've never, over the last at least decade and a half in politics, the cynical view has been where the smart money is, I think.
I've also found that the game that used to be fun at the beginning of the Obama administration, where you would do the hypothetical of what if a Republican did thing X, everyone would be losing their minds, like. Even that lost its luster after a while when it's like, well, we all know what would happen if a Republican was drone striking you know, suspected terrorists' homes on a regular basis with limited information and limited accuracy, people would in fact be losing their minds not giving the guy a Nobel Prize. But the flip side of that is probably that Trump's going to do a bunch of stuff that liberals like too, right? I mean, he's not a doctrinaire conservative. He's not an ideologue about limited government or markets, certainly. I think it's quite likely that he'll come in and institute some kind of child care tax credit as one of his very, very first actions. What's going to happen then? How are folks on the left going to process that?
Well, I guess infrastructure is another
and infrastructure,
area.
Sure, yeah.
Most presidents start out with a honeymoon period and, pretty quickly we sour on them and want a divorce. It doesn't even look like Donald Trump, who didn't even win the popular vote, is going to get much of a honeymoon period. We'll see. But I don't think – I remember when back in the heady days of capital H hope – when Obama came in, there were a lot of people on the right who were saying, "Oh my God, this is the second coming of FDR," and he's so mesmerizing and so charismatic. You know, this will fundamentally change. Well, Donald Trump is not mesmerizing, and his charisma, you know, your mileage may vary. I think he stands a very good chance of being an embattled president very, very early on.
What's your handicapping on any prospect for removal from the presidency? I mean, I'm still hearing from people who were anti-Trump, who are sort of had been holding out hope that somehow the Electoral College was going to be secretly full of faithless electors. That didn't happen. The next fallback plan is, okay, but he's going to be impeached in a hot minute. Does that strike you as realistic as someone who sort of studied the history of the presidency? Is that in the cards?
No, I mean, we've had, 2.5 impeachments in 225 plus years of constitutional history. We don't have enough impeachments, but it's certainly not proven to be a constitutional tool that is frequently used or particularly effective in removing a malicious or incompetent executive.
Tell me why you're pro impeachment. You just said we don't have enough impeachments. I want to hear why.
Well, I mean, if you just take high crimes and misdemeanors, Andrew Johnson, Bill Clinton, and Richard Nixon, who actually got he actually quit before the impeachment vote, so I count him as half.
He's the half, right?
Yeah. Well, there's certainly a lot more than 2.5 presidents who've committed high crimes and misdemeanors. I mean, you probably could have impeached there were good grounds to impeach practically every president in the 60s, and I think it is healthier in a parliamentary system where it's easier to turf out the head of government without even having an intervening election. I think that's it would make you a lot more confident about having that sort of check, that you could recall the person without too much trouble if he turns out to be, for example, somebody that cannot stop himself from ranting about Saturday Night Live on his Twitter feed and, you know, is soon enough going to have the nuclear codes in his jacket pocket.
And yet executive power has grown markedly in systems where they do have that kind of a check too. Do you think that it works only for kind of personal failings of the type that we saw in Nixon or Clinton? I mean, it doesn't seem to work as a tool to ultimately curb the growth of government. Or is there something I'm missing?
Impeachment or
– Yeah, impeachment.
Yeah, it's been totally ineffectual in terms of no confidence votes and things like that in parliament. It hasn't been a tool to stop government growth. Government growth seems to have happened in Western democracies regardless of the underlying system of government. But it certainly can be used, and I think has been used, to check erratic executives, and that
seems relevant.
Even if impeachment doesn't get rid of the national debt crisis, it would be nice to be able to throw out somebody that is dangerous.
Talk to me a little bit about transparency, which I think is the other place where I at least had relatively high hopes for Obama's presidency, and they were not realized. Do you think that the legacy that Obama leaves on transparency is the continuation of what came before him? Is it different in kind? And how does it set up Trump?
In some ways, it's a continuation of what came before him in the Bush years. The Bush administration also relied on secret legal interpretations that of things like the Patriot Act that would shock anyone who voted for it or had read the relevant parts. I think in many ways, Obama, as the liberal, high ACLU ratings, former constitutional law professor, having continued and in some ways extended this national security secrecy regime, makes it all the easier for a president who wouldn't even release his tax returns to rely on those precedents. It's the same thing with drone strikes against American citizens, in Libya, continuing. Launching a war with no congressional authorization and continuing it beyond the limits of the War Powers Resolution. What one president does becomes the baseline for what the next president can get away with.
The new normal.
Yeah. And I think Trump and Trump's people can point to, there will be a chorus of even Obama did X. And The folks who tolerated this when Obama was in office, it'll be kind of difficult for them to turn around and pretend it's some kind of dangerous innovation when the Trump administration does it.
Will it, though? I mean, you were sort of saying the safe bet is on the cynical interpretation. And I wonder if we'll simply see this effect, which is, well documented in the kind of psychological field of people incorporate negative information about political figures or public figures that they dislike differently than they incorporate negative information about people they like. So when we hear, oh, Obama droned an American citizen, people say that can't be right and sort of shovel it away and don't fit it into their worldview if they already liked Obama. I wonder if this rhetorical move of but Obama did it will actually touch how people respond to when Trump does the same thing.
Well, I think it's got to make it harder to pretend that it's something new.
Right.
So
you think at least the sort of first – the word unprecedented can't be in as many headlines maybe?
Yeah. That's no, I think if either Bush or Trump had been the first to kill an American citizen via robot death kite – there would have been a lot more outcry and a lot more pushback. It is going to be a continuation of what happened before if and when Trump does it.
Robot Death Kite. That's the name of our new band.
I stole that from someone.
So I want to talk a little bit about something slightly more cheerful, maybe.
Oh, good.
Which is, it's almost Christmas. We should do that. Which is, talk to me about what you see as the prospects for the Liberty Caucus or however you want to call them. I'm sort of looking forward to the antics of these dissenting Republicans in Congress. These guys who have already staked themselves out as saying, we're going to be the troublemakers. There's sort of a proud tradition of your Rand Paul filibusters and your Tom Coburn antics. Talk to me about what good that group can actually do to hold back what will otherwise be essentially a Republican majority in nearly every level of government. versus how much of it's just going to be rhetorical and drawing attention. Who are you keeping an eye on to kind of be a person of principle in on the Hill?
Well, certainly Rand Paul, Justin Amash, and they have, they've already signaled that. Rand Paul categorically saying he wouldn't vote to confirm Bolton, who I guess was just rejected because of his facial hair.
Yeah, the mustache seems to have done him in, which, frankly, I support. I mean, I don't love his policy approach, but the mustache really is problematic.
Yeah, I can see that. It's different. This would be one of the examples why you might be glad to have Rand Paul in the Senate, where you can make a lot of trouble and get a lot of attention for your ideas. I'd be interested to see how much of a left-right coalition can emerge. Rand Paul has talked about about AUMF reform, about reining in presidential power under this now 15-year-old delegation of congressional war power. Interestingly enough, the vice presidential nominee for the Democratic Party, Tim Kaine, has said the same thing. He's been saying it for 2 years during the whole war with ISIS, and was the first thing he returned when he returned to the Senate after losing. Was the first thing he made a speech on. So on some of these issues, there's possibility for bipartisan, if not togetherness, cooperation.
There's some of that on Fourth Amendment issues as well, right?
Sure,
we've got the
USA.
Kind of John Lewis and Thomas Massey, posse working together.
Yeah, the USA Freedom Act. So there are some of these things that cut across party lines. And, it was refreshing to see folks like Ron Wyden, who were willing to go up against the president of their own party during the Obama years. And
we should call it what it is, right?
Yeah.
Ron Wyden also got some strange new respect from us during that period, right? Suddenly we're like, oh, this guy's not so bad. Maybe he's someone we should impute good intentions to.
There are so few institutionalists left and so few people willing to take on a president of their own party. It should be encouraged wherever you find it. And I hope we see more of it from Rand Paul-style Republicans in this administration.
What about people outside of government? I'm thinking here of Sarah Palin calling out the carrier deal as crony capitalism from her like strange little perch as a real outsider now, I think. Is there anybody in that universe that you're looking to be influential? Not to say that Sarah Palin's commentary on Trump's business deals are going to turn the tides of history, but who's outside of government that you think might, who's our Rush Limbaugh? Who's somebody that people are listening to?
God, unless somebody drugs Sean Hannity, I really don't know.
I volunteer as tribute.
Yeah. One thing that this election cycle has seemed to show us is that. You certainly had plenty of elite pundits, folks like George Will, who were never Trump, but most of the staff at National Review who were never Trump from the beginning, that had, as far as I can tell, very little effect on Trump winning the nomination or the presidency. So, will it have an effect as these outside critics take him on for what he does when he's in office? I don't know. Maybe it depends on how quickly his popularity wanes. I mean, he already takes office as he and Hillary were the most reviled candidates and distrusted candidates in the entire history of polling. So he doesn't have far to fall.
And he was already working at a baseline. I mean, the entire governing structure was already working at a low baseline, right? People already hate Congress just in a generic and broad-based way. So they're not really looking there for heroes, I guess. Tell me about what you think Obama can do in his last few days here as president that could be good. Obviously, he's looking at commutations. We'll probably see some more of those. Is there anything else that this the lamest of ducks can do on his way out the door?
Yeah, I would like to see a Christmas package of commutations. That would be that'd be nice. He's historically very low on pardons, but is doing fairly well on commutations. I mean, this is one of the unilateral powers of the presidency that there's no doubt about in the Constitution, but Obama has been fairly reluctant to use it. There's been a big gap between laudable rhetoric about the drug war and mass incarceration and what he's actually been willing to do. So I think a huge package of commutations would at the end of his term would be something that he should carry out. It'd be looked at pretty fondly, I think, historically. Unfortunately, a lot of what he's been doing since the election has only he's done very little to rein in the expanded executive powers he's brought on. And in fact, in the couple weeks after the election, he officially expanded the war on terror to include al-Shabaab in Somalia as an associated force of al-Qaeda. So having,
actually just a little bit more war on his way out the door.
Seen the imperial presidency on steroids that he's passing off to Donald Trump, somebody that he says is unfit to be president, on his way out the door, he's actually, forging new frontiers in the forever war. It's not something that that gives you too much hope for positive action in his last 100 days.
Thank you very much for joining us. We will leave it on that actually totally non-optimistic note.
Merry Christmas.
This is Catherine Mengue Ward with Gene Healy for The Reason Podcast.